So, Bruce, just tell us, to those who don't know you so well. By the way, I'm Philip Weatherlake. I oversee men's stuff here, and Bruce has keenly agreed to share some of his life experience. And so tell us just a bit about yourself, Bruce, about your family, and what you like to do with yourself.
Well, I've got to that ripe old age now where I'm over 70, but I've got two kids. I've got a son and a daughter who are now have their own families. My son's a lawyer and my daughter's a doctor. My daughter lives in Perth, and I was lucky enough to get to Perth for the first time in 2.5 years last week and see my grandkids, which was terrific. And they've grown from this high to that high. My daughter has two girls, and I was thrilled last weekend that I could go camping with the oldest one, who started a journey on her Duke of Edinburgh award. And I was still able to get up and down from a camping tent and sleep on the ground. It was terrific. My wife, Jill, and I are members of the church here, although we haven't been for quite some time now because of COVID. Jill's a bit gun-shy about being in crowds still, but I think that'll get fixed. Apart from that, I'm retired. I like gardening. I enjoy photography. I'm about to head off to Tassie tomorrow on a photo workshop. And that's me.
I'll just pray for you quickly, Bruce, before we jump in. Father God, thank you for this morning. Thank you for the freshness of this morning, for the sun shining, and for Bruce's enthusiasm to share with us. Pray that you'll speak through him, especially with in mind the terrible war in Ukraine at the moment, and that's in the forefront of our minds. And just help Bruce to shed some understanding to us about the war situation and how that's managed by those within the thick of it. And may we take lessons away from that and grow closer to you as a result. In Jesus' name, amen.
What I want to tell you about today is the story of my time in Vietnam. No heroics. I was just a simple private soldier. Caught up in national service in those days. And what I want to talk to you about is really through the eyes of a 21-year-old. That's how old I was when I got to Vietnam. So you might like to think about what you were doing at 21, or kids or grandkids at 21, and think about how their experience at 21 compares to this. I was really thrilled yesterday to get to Anzac Day, which I get to regularly. I hadn't been to Anzac Day for a long time after coming home from Vietnam because us veterans got treated fairly poorly, and it wasn't safe in our heads to get out very much to Anzac Day because we never knew how people would respond. Some people got jeered and some people had red dye thrown over them in the early days. But it wasn't until the Welcome Home Parade in Sydney in 1987 that was a bit cathartic. And it felt okay to be out and expose oneself as a Vietnam veteran. I find that Anzac Day for me has a couple of interesting sort of, or gives me some interesting perspectives. It starts off with the dawn service, which starts at about 5:45. And it's a fairly simple service, although it gets embellished now with poems and readings. But it basically replicates the Stand To that every soldier on active service follows at dawn, when you face the front with your weapons ready in case someone has come up in the dark to potentially attack you. And the dawn service is a replica of the Stand To. During that time, I inevitably find myself reflecting on my grandfather's service in World War I in the trenches at the Somme. It was a horrible time. And I was saying to someone before, there was a book I found written by another sergeant in his battalion. It was called To the Last Ridge, and it describes what life was like for him, including going over the trenches and beating Germans to death with clubs. And I couldn't have done that. I just don't think I could have done that. It was a horrible time. And I don't service as a reflection time for me on the horrors of that type of war. The Anzac Day March itself, I find, is a bit of a reunion. It helps me catch up with some old mates that I've got some close bonds with. And it's also a time for me of pride, you know, when I serve the country. I was a Nasho. It was a time in 1960s and 70s when men were called up for national service. First time in Australia where national service was introduced for men to go to war. Tried national service in World War I and tried conscription, but they weren't interested in those days in sending people to war. I grew up in a Methodist church where, in a fairly sheltered family, perhaps I could have benefited from a bit more larrikinism. But we were all regular churchgoers. My grandfather was a lay preacher. I was a Sunday school teacher and I ran the youth group at church. And as a Methodist, being a Christian to me was all about behaving appropriately in God's eyes. I've never been what I'd call a very effusive Christian. I sort of think of myself more like an analogy where, you know, there are people, Christians are a bit like bottles of wine. I see people like Doug who's like a fortified bottle of port, you know, strong and resilient with a lot of depth and a lot. And I see people like Phil's daughter who's bubbly and effusive like a champagne. I see some other people who've gone off their Christianity and they're like a wine that's gone off. I think I'm just like a bottle of red wine that stands on the shelf that's got some depth and a bit of character. But that's me. Conscription in the 60s and 70s went on for a number of years. Was operated on the basis that you had to register when you were 20. The government held a lottery where they literally drew numbers out of the Tats Lotto barrel, or the original form of the Tats Lotto barrel, until they had the right numbers. It's very much a lottery, and it turned out that every 6 months there was an intake. I was in the 13th intake of National Service, in which about 1,000 young men started their military career each time from around the country. And I was devastated when I got called up. I didn't know whether I could cope. Would I die? Would I have to go to Vietnam? Would I survive? I'd avoided cadets through school like the plague. It was quite a shock for me. But as I look back on it, maybe because I came out all right, I'm very glad I went to Vietnam because I would not have had an experience like that in any other way. You know, I could have had a 2 years at Pakapunyal or at Seymour or at Victoria Barracks and never had the same sort of experience and developed the same mateships as I have now. It's a fallacy to think that all national servicemen went to Vietnam. Over the years of national service, about 800,000 men were eligible for national service. Out of that number, about 60,000 were actually called up. Of them, only 16,000 of us went to Vietnam. Quite a small number. The total number of service of people that fought in Vietnam was about 60,000 and 530-odd deaths. I had to report for duty at the engineers' barracks in Swan Street, which is now near where the Square Stadium is. And to do that, we had to fight a throng of protesters who were protesting against the war. I never understood how women could be such vicious protesters. And these were the same women that threw ink at us and red dye at us while we were doing Anzac Day marches later on. But we were welcomed inside by the military and soldiers in uniform. And when we got to Pakapunyal and got off the bus as raw rookies, they started shouting at us and they didn't stop for the rest of our recruit training. The basic training converted us from civilians into soldiers. It was about 10 weeks. We learned how to march, to fire weapons, to learn drill and discipline. And discipline was a major part of that. And that led into some quite tough forms of bastardisation. One of them was when we were all on our in our platoon of about 50 men, 60 men, were out on the parade ground. We were given 3 minutes to go and change into our PT gear and come back and do push-ups until the last person was back on the parade ground. Then we had to go and change into our pyjamas and bring the bottom sheet of our bed over our shoulder back onto the parade ground again and again do push-ups until the last person was back on. And finally, we had to go and change into our dress uniform and be back on the parade ground. Then they ran a hut inspection and found that it was untidy and gave us 2 days confined to barracks. So that was just an introduction to discipline and learning that you had to follow orders and instructions. During recruit training, we had a series of compulsory self-development lectures. And the ones that we had are some that you older folk may know by Howard Dillon, who was our padre. And these lectures, a series of 10 of them, for about an hour each, were based on loosely on the Ten Commandments. So they included a mixture of spiritual input and civil behaviour input. And it was interesting when we got up to the sixth commandment, thou shalt not kill, because that's really what we were being trained to do. And the way that they managed that was to talk about the difference between killing in combat and murder. But it helps us. I think the good armies tend to have some character building and ethics training. But it seemed to work because later on we heard from the Vietnamese that they respected us as soldiers because we honoured their dead and didn't abuse their women, which were essential parts of that training. We marched out of recruit training with a formal parade, feeling very proud of ourselves that we were now soldiers. And you would not have been able to tell the difference between us national servicemen and the regular soldiers who joined for a career. The only difference was that we had different forms of regimental numbers. We were asked for our preferences as to what specialised training we wanted to go on to. My dad had been in the service corps, so I made that my first choice. But the choices were fairly random. They turned accountants into cooks. They turned engineers into infantrymen. And they turned police officers into storemen. I was a skinny kid. I didn't have much upper body strength. And I had trouble with all the physical training, especially the ropes courses. I'd been a bushwalker, where a long, lean sort of physique was an advantage. But physically, I wasn't all that strong. So the service corps sort of suited me because that was the core of services, transport, and so on. They allocated me to the service corps training centre to become a clerk. And I didn't quite want anything that exciting. But I didn't want anything too dangerous either. And my grandfather died when I on the day of our march-out parade, and I was given 2 days' compassionate leave to get to his funeral. And when I got back to the training centre, the officer said, Private Wilson, what are you here for? I said, I want to be a driver, sir. So he said, go down there, second door on the left. And that's how I started my career in transport. And I ended up as the ducks of a class. Driver training took 6 weeks. We were taught how to handle heavy trucks, service them, handle all the paperwork, drive under conditions of threat. And I ended that course, as I said, as ducks of the class, with an army license to drive a Land Rover, 3-ton truck, 5-ton truck, and a tipper. I then spent 4 months. I can see what's wrong. I've got the connection right. I spent 4 months posted into a transport unit in Vietnam before going overseas. I didn't realise until I got there that this unit was a resupply unit for Vietnam. The OC there was a captain. He was pretty slack. He was a reserve officer who was brought in to take up a post so that the full-time officers could do active service. But he was fairly creative in the tasks he gave us. We carried hay to fire-affected farmers. We went on long drives through the regional areas of Victoria for something to do. And we spent a lot of time carrying rock from a quarry to the site of a new airstrip that was being built at Pucca. And I rolled my truck over, doing half a mile an hour going backwards, too much to the chagrin of my mates who never let me forget that I was the ducks of the class. Before going to Vietnam, our final training was at Kanunga in Queensland, just in from the Gold Coast. This was at the Jungle Training Warfare Centre. It's the only, only base in Australia that has its own cemetery. That was a bit daunting. We were trained there very heavily. You did everything at Kanunga on the run. You ran to the mess, you ran to the toilet, you ran everywhere. We did outdoor training. We practiced ambushes, we practiced cordon and search operations. We had target practice day and night, and it was in the dry season, so you'd blaze away at some targets with a flare in the sky, then race down and put out the fire that the flare had started when it came to the ground. They had an obstacle course and a harder confidence course where you had to do a sort of like of an obstacle course but under live fire, explosions going off to the side and machine gun firing overhead. And my commanding officer at the time, we had two sorts of weapons. We had a rifle which was so heavy it made my left arm an inch longer than my right one, and a little mini submachine gun that was a replacement for the World War II Owen gun. And the submachine gun was much lighter. So the boss said, boys, he said, you can take one of these F1 submachine guns with you, Kanunga. He said, they're lighter and you can run with those more easy. So we did that. But as soon as we got there, of course, they took them off us and issued us with a rifle anyway. But coming home from Kanunga, and came home by second-class rail, where we slept in the luggage rack because it was flat, and we'd broken down our weapons and put them in our bags, which had gone in the guards' van, except they didn't come off the train at Seymour. So here were we with a couple of submachine guns in the lost property office at Spencer Street. So we had frantic phone calls, and the OC said, don't worry, as long as you're on the train back, you'll be all right. So here we were waiting, three of us, waiting anxiously at Seymour Station for these bags to turn up from Melbourne again. And fortunately, they came back and we were okay. So we were pretty well trained before we went, compared to the Americans who went to Vietnam, who were probably sometimes just straight out of recruit training. You know, we'd had 9 months of quite intense training. We were probably almost trained to the level that we could take over the next higher rank if we had to. So as a result of this, we got to Vietnam. I flew on a chartered Qantas flight, which used to fly on Tuesdays, but they changed it to Wednesdays. So I spent a year and one day in Vietnam. We changed into civilian clothing as we went through Singapore in transit and to refuel, and then into Saigon, where we got to fairly sort of mid-morning. They taught us that we should be careful of anyone in black pyjamas, because they were the VC, the Viet Cong. Everyone wore black pyjamas. It was just the standard peasant dress. And so here we were sitting in the revetments at Saigon Airport, wondering about our future, and watching everybody in black pyjamas doing tasks around the airport. It was a bit intriguing. We had two sorts of enemy in Vietnam. One was the Viet Cong, who were the part-time military. They were a bit like the reservists or the local people's Communist Party members. And then we had the NVA, or the North Vietnamese regular soldiers, who were full-time soldiers and very well trained. In Vietnam, we had three centres of operation. We had a very small headquarters unit in Saigon that did all the political and the relationship work with other countries. In Vung Tau here, we had at the port, we had a logistics basis and a hospital and some storage. But most of our work happened out of our base at Nui Dat. Nui Dat just simply meant hill in Vietnamese. So every hill was called Nui Dat, but this was our base. It was a big base. It had a perimeter of 8 kilometres, a couple of coils of barbed wire around it, and guard posts every 300 or 400 metres. It was well patrolled. We patrolled it outside the base all the time, and it had been cleared to 3 kilometres of distance. So we'd moved all the Vietnamese people away from their villages to 3 kilometres away so that we weren't exposed to mortar fire or attack so easily. My unit, which was 85 Transport Platoon, was a member of the Task Force Maintenance Area. So we're a truck unit. We had three responsibilities. And what I should say is that the story I'm telling you would be different from any other Vietnam veteran, because if you were in Armoured Corps or Signals or Artillery, your story would be completely different from mine. It would also be different if you were there at a different time. Like the guys that were there after me had a different story than I have, because the war evolved. So this is just sort of my story and the ones of the guys that were with me at the time. Part of our unit, part of our responsibility was to support the task force. So we carried water and ammunition and stores around the base, except we didn't resupply the military police with water on the days that they'd booked our drivers for speeding. We just happened to overlook them. A second part of our platoon was a cargo or a general purpose unit, in which we had cargo trucks that could be configured for carrying troops or carrying cargo or be flatbed trucks. And we carried stores and fuel and ammunition out to the forward bases when we couldn't get helicopters or when road conditions would allow us to do that. The third part of our unit was a tipper unit or a dump truck unit, and we worked with the engineers to build roads on civil aid projects and associated work with tippers. We were all young. I had my 21st birthday about 5 weeks after I got to Vietnam. My platoon sergeant, who was a seasoned soldier, a career sergeant, was 23. My commanding officer was 25. We were all capable, but pretty young. We lived in tents. Each had sandbagged walls around them as a blast shield. We slept on iron frame beds with a mosquito net over us. And most of our tents had a weapon pit outside for protection in case we were mortared or came under attack. Our day started at 6 o'clock in the morning with a compulsory pill parade. We probably did look that bedraggled. So we got out of bed, had a roll call, and were issued with our anti-malarial pills for the day. Breakfast was on then. We started work at 8 o'clock and had another parade where we were issued down at the transport yard, where we were issued with our orders for the day. Our mess hut fed the whole of the TFMA, Task Force Maintenance Area, and that consisted of our platoon, a transport unit, the post office, a petrol supply platoon, cash office, Ordnance Field Park with the ammunition store, and a couple of other units that basically kept the task force active. Showers were in a shed, and we had canvas showers, like camp showers, on a pulley that we hoisted up. We had hot water that was heated, not warm water, that was heated in a 44-gallon drum with a petrol chauffeur, and we got one bucket of water per day for showering. The toilets were long-drop toilets, 6 seats in a row, and occasionally every month or so we would have tipped down a 44-gallon drum of petrol and burnt those toilets off for sanitation. The thing to do, of course, was not to go to the toilet just after it had been burnt off. Food was good. Breakfast consisted of bacon and eggs, toast, cereal. Lunch was often a salad, and evening meals were generally meat with various types of dessert. Occasionally, we'd have a barbecue. There's lots of solid food, you know, that was feeding active soldiers. In our unit, we were very rarely back at the base for lunch, so we were issued with ration packs most days for lunch, and we ate on the road as on our work site for most of the time. We ate out of aluminium Dixies because these also were served as cooking pots, and you could cook your food in those if you're out in the bush over a little hexamine stove that burnt a little tablet similar to a sort of a fire lighter. We had a wet canteen, or a boozer as it was called. We were rationed to 2 cans of beer a man per day. No spirits or wine. In fact, wine wasn't really the go in those days anyway, but 2 cans of beer a day. Being a young Methodist lad, I didn't drink a lot. I think I could count the number of beers I had in that year on 2 hands. So I used to give my beer ration away to some mates each night, and I was very popular. Occasionally we had a show from some visiting entertainers. This was the bowl was sort of at the end of the runway, so it becomes a naturally built amphitheatre and a stage, and we always liked it when the young women entertainers came and sang us songs. At Bung Tao we had a beach and a volunteer life-saving group, although I don't think they ever got called on, and a rest and care centre. And the rest and care centre had a swimming pool. I would get to drive the leave truck every month down to Bung Tao. I think it's because I didn't drink much and I could be trusted to bring the boys back again. It's amazing how much beer you can fit on a truck and hide it in chain lockers and under the engine hood and everywhere else as you came back. But I like going down to Bung Tao because it was different down there, and it was more like a standard little town, and I could catch up with a number of mates that were there and visit a few friends. It gave me the chance to go on some Red Cross tours of the area and go and see some of the local sites like the Buddha's temple and so on. The only form of contact we had with home was the mail. It took about 5 days for a letter to get to us if the posties weren't on strike and weren't black banning our mail. So getting the papers was a great way to catch up on especially the sporting events. I had a lot of friends at home. All my church family kept writing to me, and I spent hours and hours in my tent writing letters back home again. It was the only way we had. Although at the end of my time, the signals had introduced a telegram system by numbers. So there was a list of about 100 numbers, and number 36 might be, you know, I love you, and number 42 might be, I'm still alive, and number 58 meant missing you or something. So you could send home 3 numbers for a dollar, and that would get converted at Watsonia into a telegram that the post office would then deliver to whoever you'd addressed it to. Lights out was at 10 o'clock at night. And after 6 p.m. it was long pants and sleeves rolled down to prevent mosquito bites. While we were paid in Australian dollars, at the time the Australian dollar was worth $1.36 American, so roughly double what it is now. We were actually paid cash money in military payment certificates. And the Americans did this to avoid black marketing. So every now and then there would be a sudden unannounced change of MPC or military payment certificates, and we would have to change over to a new series. That, of course, meant that all the people in the Vietnamese community who'd been paid in MPC because there was no other money suddenly lost all their value, which encouraged them not to engage in black marketing or corruption. I can't remember what my pay was in those days. I got a feeling it was $60 a fortnight and free razor blades and a cake of soap. But I'm not sure about that. I got out my army paybook the other day to have a look at it, and I still can't understand how it worked. Sort of some double entry system on opposite sides of the page, and I have no idea how it works. Everyone was rostered for picket duty overnight. We were meant to work 2 hours on, 2 hours off, but we adapted it to 4 hours on, 4 hours off because it was just more convenient. And we would patrol our area of the base in pairs for security. I can remember on my second night, as we'd heard stories about how the Viet Cong flashed lights in different places to see where they were going. And I was down at the back, very back of the transport yard, and I could see this red light over there. And I thought, oh my God, what's that? Thinking it was a Viet Cong. And it turned out just to be the moonlight reflecting on the reflector of a trailer. But we were all quite sort of on tenterhooks most of the time on picket duty because our area was pretty close to the perimeter. And we needed to have some security in place. Nui Dat was a self-contained base pretty much. It was well spread out so that if we were under attack, not everything got lost at the same time, unlike Russian convoys. We had an airstrip. We had a helicopter pad for operations. We had another helicopter pad called the Pelican Pad for lifting cargo out to forward bases. And as I said before, we had a post office, a cash office, a Q store, a canteen, like a mini sort of Kmart, and a POW compound. As a transport unit, oh, that's just a view of our area. Our transport yard is up in the top left-hand corner. I think someone took that from a helicopter coming back into the base one day. As a transport unit, we actually spent more time outside our base than the infantry did. The only difference was that we weren't looking for a fight, although we were pretty prepared to defend ourselves in case one came up. The regulations basically said that every time we went outside the base, we had to put a full magazine in our rifle, load it so there was a round up the spout and put the safety catch on. And then when you came back, you'd have to clear your rifle, put the round back in your magazine and come into the base with an unloaded rifle. The problem was when you're going in and out on a tipper 7 or 8 times a day, that really got a bit onerous. So we just used to clip a full mag on our rifle and go out assuming that if we ever had a problem, it would only take a second to cock it and we could be ready to get into action. But I do remember on the first convoy that I was on, where we carried sand up from the beach at Nui Dat up for some concrete work, sorry, at Vung Tau at our logistics base, 25 or 30k up to Nui Dat. This was my second day in country, my first convoy, and I was really quite anxious. We had a driver and a co-driver who was called the shotgun. The shotgun typically stood on the passenger seat, standing up through the cupola on the roof with a rifle. And I had mine fully loaded, cocked and ready to go that day, and I was now anxiously scanning everything that was going past, thinking it was all going to be a threat. It took a few of those trips before I really was able to settle down and understand that it wasn't going to be as dangerous as that. But we were always anxious. Anxiety was always an issue. You never knew whether the man on the motorbike who was driving past you, our trucks, we'd taken the doors off our trucks so we could get in and out more easily and weren't delayed. But you never knew whether the man who was driving his motor scooter beside you with a satchel was a school teacher just going to teach a class or whether he was a Viet Cong and about to throw that satchel full of explosives into your truck. So it was always a bit anxious. One day I was driving alone through a rubber plantation. By the end of the time, it was sort of safe enough to drive single trucks rather than in convoy. I was heading through a rubber plantation up north of our base to a town called oh, I've forgotten, doesn't matter. When a bloke stepped out, Vietnamese bloke stepped outside from behind a rubber tree waving a North Vietnamese flag. Now, I was on my own. I didn't know what to do except try and run over him. When I finished my work, dropped my load off at a civil aid project we were working on. It was a load of water I had. I came back with my rifle at the ready this time. He was still there, except what he was really trying to do was sell me this flag as a souvenir. We occasionally had a stand to in our lines, or lines of tents as they were known, whenever the Viet Cong fired mortars at us. Fortunately, most of the time they went over the base and landed in the rubbish dump because they were aiming at the hill that was at the centre of our base. But there were times when our intelligence suggested that there was going to be an attack on our base, and for that time we carried our rifles everywhere. Normally we would have left them in our tent by the bed, but in those active times, code red times, we would take our rifles to the shower, to the toilet, to the mess, everywhere, and never be without it, just in case. The weapons were inspected every morning on pill parade. Sorry, they weren't. They were inspected every morning on parade at the transport yard. And if there was one tiny speck of dust in the barrel, we would be charged with having a dirty weapon, an unserviceable weapon. Actually found a good use for condoms because they worked well sitting over the top of a barrel and keeping the dust out rather than for their perhaps intended use. There was one resettled village just to the north of us called Nai Giao. It was a Catholic village that had resettled from the north where communism didn't allow for religion. And they'd resettled here, and I spent a few weeks working on a project there to build a community centre. Now, we've probably all heard about the atrocities that the Americans were meant to have performed in Vietnam, but you never heard about the atrocities that the Viet Cong performed. Within 2 days of this village being resettled, the village chief had been murdered by the Viet Cong at night, and his 2IC had been disemboweled in front of the whole village in the village square. It was just an act of terrorism. We then found, and a few weeks later, that the whole village was starving, because the Viet Cong wouldn't allow the villagers to get to the next town where the market was to buy food. So our cargo trucks just took, for some days, those villagers down to the market and back until the Viet Cong could be dealt with. One of my favourite memories was that no matter how far we went out in the field, out far in the bush, there was always a Salvation Army officer there with a Land Rover and a cup of tea. They were terrific. Each fighting unit, infantry and armoured corps, had their own padre in Vietnam, but as a sort of a consolidated unit, we didn't. There was a chapel right across the other side of the base that was a bit hard to get to. We had religion in Vietnam, or in the army in those days, was divided up into four groups. There was a Jewish group for some of the men who were Jewish. There was a Roman Catholic padre, or RC as they were known, and converted into rock crushers. There was a C of E padre, because of Church of England in those days. And then all the other Protestant denominations got melded together into OPDs. Other Protestant denominations, so Presbyterians, Methodists, Baptists and so on. So when you had your dog tags, you always had your name, service number, religion, OPD, C of E, J or whatever, and then your blood type on your dog tags. You could get to a padre if you had a problem, and they heard a lot of personal problems. But we didn't get to see one much in our group. The only time I ever really got to get to a church function, because we worked 6.5 days a week, was to get to the Roman Catholic Christmas Mass, which was held in that entertainment area not far from us on Christmas Eve. Some of our work within our base was loading pallets of ammunition and barrels of water that got flown out by helicopter out to the fire support bases in the bush. And sometimes they were lifted right off the back of my truck. Sometimes you could actually go for a joyride in one of these helicopters as they went out to drop some ammunition off and come back again. But you had to make sure that they were coming back again and not going somewhere else. Otherwise, you get charged with desertion. We all spent a couple of sessions on the garbo truck. One of the unique things about our unit was we had the only purpose-built compactor garbage truck the Army's ever owned. It's now in the Transport Museum at Bandiana. But this was an example of how you could make something out of something. A lot of the diggers, when they were due to come home, would throw out all their clothes and all their gear. And on the garbage truck, you'd collect it. The Army system was that you could exchange a damaged item for a good one, one for one. So while our uniform only consisted of two pairs of boots, two pairs of pants and two pairs of shirts, I must have had six or eight of each by the time I left because we could always, what was called L&D, loss and damage them on the garbage run. Not so much fun on the water truck. That was just hard work, picking up water from the water point and delivering it around the base. One of our largest operations on our cargo trucks was to supply an infantry unit that was an armoured unit that was operating right up to the north of our area of responsibility. The road directly north, I don't think, had been used since the French left in the 1950s, so it was considered too dangerous. So we had to sort of do a triangular dogleg to get up there to resupply them. There were tanks, armoured personnel carriers, a battalion of infantry and some helicopters. This was just before Tet in 1970, Chinese New Year, and the intention was to block the North Vietnamese Army from getting across into Saigon like they'd done the previous year. So this was a three-day trip for us. We were escorted by two armoured personnel carriers and a gun jeep, and a helicopter overhead for some of the trip. For two nights, we stayed... this is just us assembling in one of the towns before we moved on a bit more. We stayed at this American base overnight, and this was quite an experience for us. We hadn't encountered something like this before. So we drove up to this base. Next day went out and resupplied our tanks, came back to this base and then came back to our home base, back to Nui Dat, over 3 days. And when we got here, we were the first people to get to the mess, and we picked up our food trays, sat down at a convenient table ready to eat dinner, until an American soldier came over and gave us an experience in the most gross form of racism we'd ever encountered. He said, "Boys, don't sit there. That's where the niggers sit." And we were stunned. You know, we had never encountered that sort of attitude anywhere before. Just horrible. You know, our engineer in charge of our rubbish dump was an Aboriginal. His nickname was Nugget. Now, you wouldn't call an Aboriginal Nugget anymore, and you wouldn't put him in charge of the rubbish dump anymore either. But we'd never thought about blacks versus whites. It was just something so foreign to us. We did like the American equipment, though. We liked their firepower, but we just didn't like their attitude much as soldiers. They were inexperienced. Some of them had no idea where they were or where they were going. And on the ice run, we used to go down to our logistics base at Vung Tau and take a couple of tippers and pick up blocks of ice. Now, a block of ice might have been almost 2 metres long and half a metre square. And that was used in the messes to preserve food because often the fridges couldn't cope. We used to sell chicken feathers. We ran over a chicken in the villages, you know, little bantam chickens with coloured feathers. We used to sell those to the Americans for a dollar each as kangaroo feathers. Some of our injuries weren't caused by sort of military action. They were caused by what probably we'd call industrial accidents, like rolling our truck on its side. One of our members had his face really badly injured in a truck crash and had his face put together by some American plastic surgeons. He still looks 15 years younger than us to the day. One day we were tasked to clear a fire support base. Whenever our infantry were operating in a remote area, we'd establish a base with three guns to be able to be in range to support them. And when that operation was over, we'd pull all this stuff back to Nui Dat. Well, one day in a little fire support base, we had a little D4 bulldozer bogged in some mud. And we thought, well, if we could just give it some traction, we'll get it out of there. And on each of our trucks had a winch cable. So I rolled out the winch cable, hooked it onto the dozer and tried to pull it in. I had my heel on the accelerator and my foot on the toe on the brake. Sorry, the other way around. And the more revs I gave the winch, all that happened was my truck got dragged into the bulldozer. So we thought, we'll fix that. We attached another truck behind me with some chains, put it in reverse and pulled again. And by this time, a whole platoon of Vietnamese soldiers had lined up, sort of like this aisleway, had lined up either side to watch what was happening. And then the winch brake snapped. And it snaked. And I have no idea to this day how we didn't decapitate anybody in that sort of action. Mostly I enjoyed driving tippers. They were good fun. We worked with the engineers building roads. And it took a bit of skill to lay out some screenings to a depth of 6 inches or 9 inches or a foot or whatever the engineers wanted. You know, it took quite a bit of skill. And that was fine. We'd occasionally be out at night after curfew at 6 o'clock, filling in culverts that had been blown up by the Viet Cong, or in one case, a whole bridge that was destroyed. And we were heavily protected at those times, but they were very late nights. So after a year, my time was up. It was time for me to come home. So I arrived home with 3 months left to serve. We actually had to pay for our own airfares to get home domestically. The army system at that time was that they would pay for a second-class rail ticket. So if you wanted to get home a bit quicker from Melbourne to Sydney back to Melbourne, you had to pay for your own airfare. And I had all the family meet me at the airport, at Essendon as it was then. So there I was, a machine gunner on a gun jeep escorting convoys on Monday, and home with Mum on Wednesday. No transition at all. I had 6 weeks of leave accrued, so I spent that time revisiting family and friends. I learned something about mothers, because I think mother's job is to worry. And I remember going out on the second night I was home, with a couple of mates, and I slunk home about 2 o'clock in the morning and turned the key in the back door and quietly crept into my bedroom, and I heard my mother call out, "Is that you, Bruce?" And I said, "Yes." She said, "Oh, good, I can go to sleep now." And I thought, "What have you been doing for the last year?" But that's mothers. I do remember, though, with that very short transition, going shopping with Mum, going up to the local shops, and there was suddenly a sudden sort of explosion. It might have been a car backfiring or a sudden loud noise, and I found myself lying in the gutter with my hands over my head. And Mum said, "What on earth are you doing?" I said, just what I did last week. The company that I work for had to give me my job back by law after I got back. They'd actually employed somebody else to do the sort of work I was doing. And I settled down after a bit of temporary resentment and got back to work. And I was glad to be back as a civilian. But memories do keep lingering on. Not long ago, I was actually buying a fountain for our garden, a water feature. And the guy that ran the store was telling me he had a brother who was killed in Vietnam. And he learnt that I had a diary, which I'd kept. So I loaned him my diary. And it turned out that I actually took him on my truck out to that operation where he was killed. So things just keep coming back occasionally. But I learned a lot out of those that year. And let me tell you some of the things that I reckon I learned. Jill tells me that the best things were that I learned how to iron clothes, do hospital corners to make the bed, and fold my clothes up properly. But I think the things I really learned, sorry, I missed a couple of things here, were these. When I was in America a couple of years ago, I went to the Second World War Museum, and this saying was on the wall. Ken and I were talking about it before. You cannot send a man to war and expect him to come home the same. Now, I sort of had a positive effect, I think, because I matured a lot. I was engaged to a girl before I went, and when I got back, she'd dematured about 5 years and I'd matured about six. And that relationship just didn't ever go anywhere. I met my wife, Jill, later on. But I think we have to understand that war is a horrible time. It requires people to do more, in many cases, than is humanly possible. And some people just get terribly affected by that. So that was one lesson. If you're going to send people to war, the government needs to look after them and take care of them because you come back a different person. The other thing I learnt and got reinforced later in life as well is don't underestimate young people. You know, for us old blokes, it's really very easy to say, oh, young people don't know anything. You know, they couldn't have done any of this. But that's not true. For a group of 20-year-olds in Vietnam or a group of 16-year-olds that hold McDonald's together, give people good leadership and a structure and a framework and they'll achieve a lot. So young people shouldn't be written off. They should be helped to achieve, and I think they're very, very capable of that. I learned that it's not helpful to judge people. I used to drive past people like this quite often and think, ah, look at these Vietnamese people. Yeah. But these were humble farmers trying to eke out a living. They were school teachers going off to teach a class. They were doing all the things that you and I want in our lives. And judging them, I don't think, is helpful. This is not easy to do. It's still very easy to judge someone and say, oh, he's only whatever, she's only one of those. But I think we have to accept people for what they are. And if we do that, I think we're better Christians. I learned that everyone has something to offer. You just got to tap into it. One of the guys in my unit worked for the tax department, so he could give tax advice to people. I knew a bit about cameras, so when anyone would buy a new camera, I could teach them how to use it. Some guys were just good for their physical ability. They were strong and tough and had physical ability. But if you understood what people could contribute, you could use that to everybody's advantage. I learnt later, perhaps, but it evolved from Vietnam, is that when you're stressed, people behave to the best of their capability. That's why I never, in my career as an organisational psychologist, I was never very good at counselling. Because I could always say, oh, you've got to do better than that. Now, surely you can do better than that. But I had to realise that their behaviour was the best they could offer at the time. And if we can understand that, and if we can work with that, we can get places. I think it's helpful to learn about the context in which you're operating. You know, I used to drive past these shanties regularly, and I used to look on them and think, God, what a life that is. But I didn't understand that these were all displaced people, and this was the best accommodation they could get in a war zone. I would have had a whole different attitude to them if I had have understood that at the time. So whether you're in business or wherever, understanding the context in which you're operating, I think, is really important. And you do that by asking a lot of questions. Why is that happening? What's the reason for that? I learnt that if you want something, you've got to go and make it happen yourself. This was a typical sleeping arrangement for four men in a tent. When I got there, we had to build our own tent because there wasn't enough. But then we had to find beds and mosquito nets and lockers. I slept on a stretcher for 3 weeks. And I guess I could have complained and said, well, the army should do something about this. But I solved the problem much more quickly by going and scrounging one from somewhere else. I think Australians are good scroungers. And I scrounged a bed, and I scrounged the mosquito net came with it, but I scrounged a locker, which was a packing case. But you've got to go and do it. So I think you've got to take the initiative to get what you want, because other people don't know what you want, and you're responsible for your own actions. And finally, I reckon, try. You might just succeed. If you don't try, you're not going to succeed in anything. This little kid was being teased by the soldier from the top of his truck who was trying to get his hat. And this kid just kept trying. And eventually he grabbed the hat and ran away. And then the soldier had to go and explain why he'd lost part of his uniform. But if this kid didn't try, yeah, he wouldn't have had a hat. So that's my story. You're welcome. Thank you for listening. You're welcome to look further if you like, because the diary that I kept is actually on my website. If you look at wilsons.id.au, you'll find my diary or an electronic version of it. You're welcome to read it at your leisure. So thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much, Bruce, for a fantastic insight and a completely different life to what almost I think any of us could have experienced in that, out of the context of Vietnam. And there were some fantastic lessons you shared at the end, were just terrific. Just time, I haven't got much time, but anyone's got one or two questions, I'll run over the mic. Carlo.
You mentioned not drinking because of your faith background. Mm-hmm. Did that have any other, like, were you seen as different, or were most people have some sort of faith, or did they treat you differently?
Look, I can't remember really, but I think what really happened was, that I was grateful for, was I think my upbringing had given me a solid sense of right and wrong. And I had this sort of substance behind me that I think helped me with ethics and morality. That would be the best way for me to answer that.
Another quick one. Oh, I'll get Peter. Oh, and one more there.
Thanks, Bruce. Great story. I was potentially in that group back in the late 60s that could have had their number come up. It was actually a date, wasn't it? And if you they picked your birth date out of the hat, you were liable to be called up. My date didn't come up, so that didn't come up. But I thought a lot about it at the time. I had done cadets at school. I was, you know, happy using a rifle and all that. But by the time I was a bit later, a bit older, I decided if my number had have come up, I would have conscientiously protested against that. I would have tried not to go. And I know there was a few people, others in the community, that got a lot of publicity who were objectors like that. I just wondered, did you have any consideration about that when you were called up?
I think we respected those people that did have a conscientious objection, and even those that got called up, I think, got that sorted out within a little while. For me, I think I'm pretty much a middle-of-the-road person. I'm not an extreme for or against person. I think I'm sitting in the middle in most things, and I was sort of happy to take my chances. You know, if I went, I would go. If I didn't go, well, that was fine. But I didn't have any really hard feelings either way. I was sort of in the middle for me.
Okay, question from Jono.
Yeah, so you mentioned that the experience in the war brought up a lot of maturity that you had in you. I was wondering if you had, looking at modern society, there were any experiences that young people could put themselves in that would bring out a similar maturity?
Well, that's a good question. I don't think that we should enforce people to go into the army. You know, a lot of people would say, oh, we should bring back national service. That would sort the kids out. I really don't believe that. I see some people who matured significantly, and I see other people who have been detrimentally affected. Like one of my mates I went through recruit training with ended up in jail for 18 months for some infraction. But that was because he never was able to... He was a soft, gentle guy, and they gave him the worst job ever, which was to be an ambulance driver at the hospital. And that affected him significantly. And for him, you know, that army experience was not a good idea. I just think, for me, I guess part of my experience with bushwalking and so on, I think all of those community organisations like the Duke of Edinburgh Award, scouting, guiding, are the sort of things that give people some skills in life and some structure, and I think they're very helpful.
Okay, maybe one more question, that's it. Ron.
Thanks, Bruce. You mentioned about the ridiculous things that have to be done, and it's training to follow orders. How do you sort of view, could the army do better, or is that one of those things that you've mentioned that some people respond to that and others can't? What's your...
I think the army is now very different. The people that I talk to who are currently serving members have different experiences. I think that was a hangover from sort of World War II, where the mentality was you got to beat people into shape. I think it's sort of like training cats or dogs and horses. You know, there are other ways, more gentle ways to achieve the same result. And you don't need to beat things into shape. So I don't think it's the same anymore.
Sorry?
I don't think it's the same anymore.
Oh, okay.
I think it's really quite different.
Yep, thank you.
Oh, good. No, thanks everyone for your questions. Drew out a bit more. Good stuff. So, thanks, Bruce, for everything. I'll just pray for you briefly while we wind up. Father God, I pray that you'll bless Bruce as he goes on in life. May he be a quiet witness for you as he continues to share the lessons he's learned from his life experiences. In Jesus' name, amen.